Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week, we had a conversation with longtime Nation columnist and feminist Katha Paulett about her new book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. In the book, Katha Paulett reframes abortion as a common part of a woman's reproductive life, one that should be accepted as a moral right with positive social implications. We received several questions and comments about how abortion should be reframed, so we decided to have Katha back to continue the conversation. And if you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk about how abortion should be reframed, if you'd like to share a personal story, and then also if you're a young person, what really resonates with you, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. We also mentioned that in recent years, more than 200 state laws have passed to restrict abortion access. So how would you reframe this issue? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Katha Paulett is an essayist, poet, and columnist for The Nation. Her new book is Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. And she joins me here in studio. Hi, Katha. Thanks for coming in.
Rose, thanks so much for having me back.
It's great to have you. So since you've been on, we got some fairly big news. Cecile Richards, the head of Planned Parenthood, talked about her personal abortion story in an essay in Elle magazine. And she writes, and it's exactly what you're calling for. She wrote, quote, "I had an abortion. It was the right decision for me and my husband, and it was not a difficult decision. Before becoming president of Planned Parenthood 8 years ago, I hadn't really talked about it beyond family and close friends. But I'm here to say, when politicians argue and shout about abortion, they're talking about me and millions of other women around the country." End quote. And so she's basically saying, we need to speak out. And that's exactly what you say in your book.
Maybe she read my book.
Maybe she did.
Well, you know, it's really interesting, Rose, that several people who have reviewed my book have used it as the occasion to talk about their own abortions. Hmm. And I think that I would love to think that the book will spark that kind of openness. When you think of how gays and lesbians changed the conversation, if you can call it a conversation, around gay rights, lesbian rights, and gay marriage, and single-sex marriage, by coming out to people who knew them. Instead of thinking, oh, those weird people, you thought, oh, this is my colleague, George, and this is my cousin, you know, Susan.
Right.
I think that women, when you think over a million women have an abortion every year, that is a lot of people. One in three women will have had an abortion by menopause. That's a very powerful block of voices there.
What do you think about Cecile Richards' decision to come out? How significant is this?
Well, I think it could be very significant. I suppose there'll be people who say, well, yeah, of course, she'd have an abortion. She's the head of Planned Parenthood. But I think that the more people speak out, the more courage it gives to other people. I met a woman in Minneapolis last week at a literary festival, and after I gave my reading, she said, you know, I had an abortion and I haven't told anyone, not even my best friend. And I said, well, what do you think would happen if you told your best friend? And she said, I think she'd tell me that she'd had an abortion too. Mm. So I get this picture of so many women who are separated from sympathy, from understanding, from empathy and solidarity because they feel they can't say anything.
Hmm. So you're just starting your tour, and it'll be interesting to find out what you do hear from women. And I bet this story will be told to you over and over again.
Yes, I think so. I think it will. And all I can say is I hope that, you know, that the book changes the discourse a little bit around abortion.
So last time you were on, you talked about how you want more people to step out and come out like Cecile Richards did, and to really focus on the fact that this is a moral good, that this actually helps women. Where do you want that conversation to start? Because it's so interesting. I'd love to have Cecile Richards on sometime to ask her about why Planned Parenthood distanced itself from using the word pro-choice last year, and now Cecile Richards is coming out. Where do you want this to start?
Well, I think the way we frame abortion now is very defensive. it's as if we're listening to the talking points of abortion opponents and trying to give them a little twist. So abortion opponents will say, oh, a woman who has an abortion is confused. She's being coerced. They don't so often say, you know, she's an evil slut, because that didn't go over too well. So now it's she's confused. She hasn't thought it through. She doesn't know what abortion involves. And then the pro-choice side says, oh, no, she does. Abortion is the most difficult decision she'll ever make. Women really agonize over this. They say this a lot. And what that says is, It isn't what Cecile said it was. It isn't an easy decision in the sense that, although it might be sad and painful because part of you wants to have a baby or you hope to have a baby someday and you will, or you, et cetera, that it's not a difficult decision in the sense that you're thinking, oh, yesterday nothing was further from my mind than having a baby now because I'm in school, but maybe I should have a baby now. You know, I think that we end up stigmatizing abortion inadvertently when we talk about it that way.
And in the essay, Cecile Richards wrote, quote, there's a big difference between sharing your story and being forced to justify your decision.
Exactly. Exactly. And the it's the worst, hardest decision she'll ever make is a way of justifying the decision, because abortion is just as much a right if you don't have to think 5 minutes about it, as if you spend, you know, months thinking about it.
It's interesting that she chose to write this in Elle magazine. This is a fashion magazine.
Well, yeah.
And I think it's great when people do this, rather than, for example, a progressive alternative, right? And it's interesting to read the comments from the women who are reading it. What do you think about that decision?
Well, you know, Elle magazine, these fashion magazines often have a real feminist streak in them. Elle magazine reviewed my book at tremendous length, and it'll be in the November issue, and it's also online by Laurie Abraham, who's a wonderful editor and writer there. And she talked about her abortion. And she also talked about the book. Cosmopolitan.com is just a hotbed of feminism now. And I was interviewed there. So I think we don't want to write these magazines off, you know.
Right.
It's not just perky breasts. It's also
well,
abortion rights.
It does reach a different audience. It's easy to sort of put your nose
exactly.
up and say, I don't read that. But it reaches a huge audience.
Exactly. And I think the internet has made it possible for pieces to leap from one audience to another. It starts out at Cosmo, and then people post it, and, you know, it goes around. So things are not as balkanized as they used to be.
Right. And these magazines pay a lot better than the alternative press. Well, we've got a couple of callers on the line, and if you'd like to join us with Katha Pollitt, the number is 866-798-8255. Last week, we had Katha on to talk about how to reframe abortion, and we had such a great response when we heard that she was coming into town to promote her book. We decided to have her back on, and you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you're a young person, we'd love to hear from you, what really resonates with you. If you work with a reproductive justice group, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about the changing messages and the fact that there's a lot of apologizing going on? The Democrats embrace the safe, legal, and rare motto. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Katha will be at Book Passage in Corte Madera tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and then she'll be at Berkeley Arts and Lectures at the Hillside Club tomorrow night at 7. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Well, I'm not a young person. I'm an old person.
That's fine.
Who had an abortion in, let's see, 1973, I think it was. I have a question and a comment. First of all, I was wondering about that Mexican abortifacient pill that you mentioned last week.
Yeah.
I know that before Roe, and even now, if, you know, people give themselves illegal abortions, and that is it's not really an abortion. It's not something that pulls a fetus out of you. It chemically traumatizes the womb so that it induces a miscarriage. So it poisons you, basically. And I was wondering if that pill does that. And the other things I wanted to say is that I really appreciate Katha for all her work over the years. I used to carry an article by her around. It was a letter to Nat Hentoff. It was very funny.
Oh, I remember that.
I used to carry copies of it and give it to people.
That was a long time ago.
That was a long, long time ago. Yeah. But, I agree with your position. We should be unapologetic about choice and call it choice. I myself am very unapologetic and proud of my own abortion because I feel that I didn't have a child that I wouldn't have raised well. I didn't want. I couldn't financially support. Didn't have a father around. and I didn't contribute to overpopulation with an unwanted child, you know. And I also felt really good after I got over, after the night I had, after I had the abortion, because I wasn't, didn't have that morning sickness all the time. And I just walked around for hours that night, and I scored a new job in the middle of the night. I found a place to work. And also, I wanted to say that my friends, I had a couple of friends who had pre-Roe abortions. One of them said it was the worst pain she ever had in her life. And, of course, it was like a really horrible, sleazy doctor, and really in an alley. And the other one was hemorrhaging for years mm. after her abortion because of this trauma thing. That's what abortions, those abortions do. So I say, yes, abortion safe and legal, on demand, without apology. And I went to make a little pro-choice movie one time. That's what the freedom of not having that child did for me. Mm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Judy.
Well, thanks a lot for that. I just want to get back to the, because I think people out there really need to know what you said about the Mexican abortion pill. It's not really a Mexican pill. It's sold over the counter in Mexico, and it's called misoprostol, and it's an ulcer medication that has this other use. And actually, it's quite safe. It produces a miscarriage 85% of the time. It does not poison you. And it has, in countries where abortion is illegal, the use of misoprostol has lowered the injury and death rate from illegal abortion a lot, where doctors used to see many more women who come in with, you know, they've been using coat hangers or knitting needles or whatever. This is much safer than the illegal alternatives. And that's what women are using now in Texas, where they've closed so many clinics mm. south and west of San Antonio. It's really, you know, there are no abortion clinics. So that's what women are doing. Now, the danger is that they'll buy the pill and they don't know two things. One is the proper dosage of it. That because often they'll be buying it like from a flea market, or they're buying it from a pharmacist who doesn't know the proper dosage, a pharmacist in Mexico who doesn't know the proper dosage to procure an abortion. So it's very, very important that people who use this get the proper information about it. The other thing is that women who self-abortion is illegal. So if you have a miscarriage and you're worried and you go to the hospital and they ask you, well, how did this happen? Just remember, you don't have to tell them that you took that pill. I mean, it's not going to be such an issue in Florida, in California. But, right. you know, anyone who's out there, that spread the word, you do not have to tell.
And you brought this up last week, and I want to mention it again because it's getting some media attention, but it's for the most part died down. The New York Times reported this in late September. On September 12th, Jennifer Whalen, a 39-year-old mother of three in the rural town of Washingtonville, Pennsylvania, went to jail to begin serving a 9-to-18-month sentence. Her crime was, in effect, ordering pills online that her oldest daughter took in the first several weeks of an unplanned pregnancy when she was 16 to induce a miscarriage. The medication was formerly called RU486.
No.
Isn't that what it was called? Or did they
No, RU486 is a different medication. Misoprostol is this thing that's over-the-counter in Mexico. RU486 is the French abortion pill, and that's called mifepristone. I don't know if she was
this
using
was a,
that.
This was a combination of the two.
Yeah, the combination of the two is what if you went to an abortion clinic and wanted a what they call now a medication abortion, you would get both these medications. One stops fetal development and the other stops the womb from responding. And it expels the fetus, the embryo, because you can only do this in the first 2 months or so of pregnancy. I thought it was misoprostol she was using, but maybe I'm wrong. But these are different medications, which are also often confused with emergency contraception, which is what you take if you have unprotected sex. If you take this right away, within 3 days, it will help you stay unpregnant. But it is not an abortion, although the anti-abortion people want you to think that it is.
This reporter, Emily Bazelon, went to speak with the mother before she went to jail, and she said that the closest clinic was about 75 miles away. They had to wait 24 hours, and the cost would have been between $300 and $600 because they don't have health care. And that's why she decided to do this.
Right, because she could get these pills for like $45, which was what makes me think it isn't RU46. RU46 is pretty expensive. But anyway, whatever. But here's a mother trying to help her daughter do what her daughter wants, and she is now in prison. Now, the interesting thing is it took Pennsylvania 2 years to figure out a way to charge her under the laws of the state. So they were really determined to get her and make an example of her. And you just think, you know, abortion is legal in Pennsylvania. Abortion is legal in Pennsylvania, and here's a woman who's in prison for more than a year for that.
Well, we will link to this lengthy piece at yourcallradio.org. And let's go to our next caller. Let's hear from Mimi in Monterey. Hi, Mimi. If you can turn down your radio. Hi, Mimi. You're on the air, but please turn down your radio.
Oh, I did.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to call in last week, but there were so many calls I didn't get to. But I wanted to bring up 2 points. One, when it comes to these major issues, such as abortion and things like that, what's rarely discussed is how it affects different cultures. I know that there was a study done, I guess, over the period of time up until, I believe, 2000, from when abortion was legalized, up until 2000, where basically they did the number of abortions that were done, and it rated, like, in the different communities, whether it's a Hispanic community, African-American community, Caucasian community, et cetera, and they found that when it came to the African-American community, basically 1 in 4 babies were terminated, whereas every other culture or race was in double digits. And I've always wondered why that's never been looked at.
I think I understand your question is that black women have more abortions per capita than other...
Any other culture.
Is that what you're saying? Well, I wouldn't call all black people a culture. But as an ethnicity or a race, it's true that black women do have more abortions, and they always have. And when abortion was illegal, black women were vastly, disproportionately, died from illegal abortions. And that was one of the things that that Justice Blackmun thought about in the Roe decision, was that there's a racial angle to making abortion illegal that hits black women harder. Well, why do black women have more abortions? Well, I think it's because they have poorer health care, for one thing. They tend to be poorer, and that means they have poorer health care. They have less access to really good birth control. A lot of people think, oh, yeah, birth control. Anybody can get birth control. That's what the Republicans are saying now. You know, you just go to Walmart, $6. Well, it's not true. It isn't true. Birth control is complicated. Not every method works for every person. And black women are particularly likely to get poor health care and to have poor access to long-lasting methods like the IUD, where under the Affordable Care Act, we're hoping it will become more accessible because that's supposed to provide every method of birth control with no copay, because it costs about $1,000 to get an IUD put in, and if you have to pay it out of pocket, it's still to your advantage because over time it pays for itself because it lasts for, 10 years. But that's a lot of money for someone to pay out. And I think what you have in the Black community is people are poor. They're leading difficult lives. They have as many children as they can support, and they want to raise the children that they have well. Most abortions, but a lot of people don't know this, most abortions are with women who already have kids. 60% of women who have abortions have children. So this picture we have of it's all these promiscuous teenagers out there, that's not true. All these promiscuous 20-somethings, all these cold-hearted career women who hate children. No, it's mothers. Hmm. So think about that, what that says about birth control, about your ability to control, your sexual experiences, and about your poverty.
Yeah, that's, as you say, it's really not mentioned during this conversation. What other myths are there about abortion?
Well, one myth that a lot of this is how a lot of women who have abortions in their 40s get pregnant is they think they're not fertile. This was amazing to me, is somehow doctors are saying to women something that women interpret as you can't get pregnant. And you'll find a lot of women, when asked, well, why weren't you using birth control? They'll say, well, I thought I couldn't get pregnant. And you're thinking, well, how did you get that impression? Infertility is not very common. Women do get pregnant even in their 40s. And in your 20s, you're extremely fertile. So I would say, there are all these misconceptions people have that, and one of them is, for example, okay, abortion is dangerous. Abortion is dangerous. In abortion, well, we'll send you to hell. Of course, we don't know whether that's going to happen, but I'm betting against it. I read that in Ireland, where women can't get an abortion, they have to go to England. Half of the women who do this think they're going to go to hell for having an abortion, but they still have the abortion. They still have it because it's that important to control their fertility. Mm.
Well, and also to Mimi's point, and thanks for calling in, according to the Guttmacher Institute, 42% of women who have abortions are poor. 42%.
Yes, yes. And I think that really speaks to two things. One is how inferior our health care is, reproductive health care is, so that if you're depending on, public clinics and things like that, you're really in trouble. And the other is how little we do for mothers. I think that, it's been cut for years. I mean, welfare reform was in 1994 already, and it hasn't gotten any better for poor women. And now we're seeing, there's a lot of unemployment. There's a lot of denial of benefits of any kind for women and children. That's the big fad now. So it's not so surprising that a woman with no money is going to think, maybe I shouldn't have this baby now. Mm.
Today we are talking with Katha Pollitt about her new book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. We had Katha on last week, and we had so many questions and calls about how to reframe abortion, we decided to have her back. We'd love to hear from you. What do you think resonates with young people, and how should this issue be reframed? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
There are lots of ways to take part in today's conversation on your call, on the phone, or by sending an email. The address is feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can just leave a message on the yourcallradio.org website. The number to call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC. Today, Nigeria and Ebola. The World Health Organization has declared Nigeria officially free of Ebola after 6 weeks with no reported cases. It is, says the World Health Organization, a spectacular success story. Senegal was also declared free of disease just last week. World Have Your Say, coming up at 11.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, we will continue our election coverage by having a debate about Proposition 47, which would reduce the classification of non-serious and non-violent property and drug crimes from a felony to a misdemeanor. Proponents say money spent on incarceration should be spent on social programs, while opponents say Prop 47 fails to punish potentially dangerous felons and will burden the system. So what questions do you have about Prop 47? And then Wednesday, we will have a pre-taped conversation with Laura Poitras, director of the new documentary Citizen 4, which is about Edward Snowden. The film comes out soon. Edward Snowden contacted Laura Poitras, and she connected with Edward Snowden, who then recommended she reach out to Glenn Greenwald, and that's how it all played out. So if you have any questions for Laura Poitras, who now lives in Berlin, email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org, and she's in town to talk about the film Citizen 4. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I am joined in studio by Katha Pollitt, an essayist, poet, and columnist for The Nation. She's out with a new book, Pro: Reclaiming Abortion Rights. In the book, Katha reframes abortion as a common part of a woman's reproductive life, one that should be accepted as a moral right with positive social implications. And Katha will be speaking tomorrow at Book Passage in Corte Madera, 1 o'clock. And then tomorrow night, Berkeley Arts and Letters over at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7 p.m. And if you have any questions or comments for Katha, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on misconceptions about abortion? How do you think it should be reframed? And if you're a young person or you work with young people, what really resonates with you or them? You can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Eleanor who says, I was the first caller in last week's discussion. I'm so glad you're continuing this conversation because abortion rights are deep and nuanced. When I had a second trimester termination for a non-viable fetus, the word choice did not fit. What I chose was to get pregnant and have a baby, but that didn't happen with that pregnancy. I had to choose it a second time. I've been thinking about the words. I'm pro-autonomy because I don't need the opinions of strangers. I'm pro-reality because sometimes you can have a baby and sometimes you can't.
Those are great words. I think we should rebrand ourselves as pro-reality. That's terrific. No, I mean, some abortions are so sad to have to abort a wanted child because something's gone terribly wrong. But you know, people out there ought to realize it's not as if the anti-choice people want you to be able to have those medical abortions either. What they want is for you to carry that non-viable fetus, dying fetus, and have, you know, your precious 5 minutes with it. So they want you to go through the whole stress and strain and of pregnancy and childbirth to deliver a dying baby. It is so cruel, so cruel.
Well, thank you for emailing us and sharing your story, Eleanor. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Maury in San Francisco. Hi, Maury.
Oh, good morning. And thank you so much for doing this follow-up show. And thank you to Katha. First, I want to say that I had an abortion, and I've never regretted it. I grew up very poor and won a scholarship to an Ivy League school, and 2 weeks before classes were to begin, I discovered that I was pregnant because a condom had failed. And it really would have altered the entire course of my life had I not had access to abortion. And so that's one. And the second thing is, you know, I understand the religious opposition to abortion. Like, I understand the Catholic Church position that a life is a life is a life, even though I don't agree with it, but I understand it. I don't understand all these men who oppose abortion, and it seems to me when I see parades and things that there's an overwhelming number of men in the opposition. So I wonder, can you talk about the psychology for men who oppose abortion? Like, what's the basis for that? Is it their power is undermined? If women have autonomy or sovereignty, and the word I would use in reframing it is personal sovereignty.
Personal sovereignty is also good, although it's a little long. You know, it's a lot of syllables. You know, you raise a very interesting aspect of these issues. What is the piece of it that is about men? You know, I will say that polls show there's not a big difference between men and women on this issue, but I think that there's an intensity difference. I think, you know, I've never been to a pro-choice conference where women didn't vastly outnumber men and where the men that were there were gay, which is, I really don't understand this. I mean, it's great that they're there. But, you know, it is, you know, it's something that I think a lot of men just think, I don't have to think about this. It's not really, until they do have to think about it, until their girlfriend is pregnant. But, you know, why are there men who are so virulently anti-choice? Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that it's because abortion is a decision that only a woman gets to make. You know, and there are countries where you can have an abortion with your husband's permission, but we don't have that. The Supreme Court struck down spousal consent and then spousal notification. So I think a lot of men feel, hey, that's my baby. Who's she to get rid of it? Even if they would want to get rid of it themselves, you know. I think a lot of it is religion. I think it is religion. I think this isn't the most fashionable view, but if you look at the religions that are really gung-ho about banning abortion, it's the Catholic Church and fundamentalist evangelical denominations like the Southern Baptists. Well, these are tremendously patriarchal religions. The Southern Baptists have as an official doctrine, if you can believe this, wifely submission. You have to submit to your husband. So they're certainly not going to be in favor of saying you have to submit to your husband, except when you want to kill your baby, quote unquote.
It is interesting. Because when you watch the documentaries, like on Frontline, for example, men do play very prominent roles in these documentaries, the anti-choice men.
Yes.
And even here in San Francisco, a lot of people don't realize that in front of Planned Parenthood, there are protesters, and they're usually men.
Yes. Oh, it used to be even more male-dominated than now. But the anti-choice movement has become much more media savvy and politically savvy. And now they see, you know, you can't just have a movement that's a lot of men standing up there telling women what to do. Mm. There have to be women involved in a prominent way.
Right. And in fact, when the Lilly Ledbetter case was argued in front of the Supreme Court, I thought it was really interesting. The majority of the spokespeople for that side were young women.
For the anti
birth control side.
Uh-huh. Well,
yeah.
Lilly Ledbetter was about
I'm thinking of the store, the craft store.
Hobby Lobby.
Hobby Lobby,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, they're very good. They're good at that now. It's just the way if you're accused of rape, you want a woman lawyer. You want to blur the gender piece of it. But, you know, there are a lot of women who are opposed to legal abortion. It's not strictly men versus women. Because there are a lot of women who believe that women's destiny and her proper role is to have children. And they want a society in which, in their fantasy life, men marry women in order to have a sex life and to have a family life. We don't live in that world. In fact, that world has never really existed to the extent that they think. But they see the passing away of an old understanding about men and women, and they don't like that.
Well, thank you for calling in, Maury. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Katha Pollitt is joining us again to talk about reframing abortion and her new book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. She'll be speaking tomorrow at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 1 o'clock, tomorrow night at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7. And let's go next to Denise in San Francisco. Hi, Denise.
Thank you. Good morning. Well, for one, I had an abortion in 1987 that was called therapeutic. based on a prescription that was given to me that was unsafe for my child. And then the OBGYN said, oh, this would be medically indicated to stop this pregnancy, which was totally against my beliefs, but I didn't want my child to suffer, to be poisoned. So I had this procedure, and it was an antidepressant that I was on, and then I end up, you know, more depressed, feeling more objectively suicidal, since I had blood on my hands, and the one doctor, you know, destroyed the evidence of the other doctor's, you know, crime against me by giving me lack of informed consent. So I would like to see some choice for women who, you know, who want to be mothers and who, you know, not to be coerced by, you know, by these other physicians and by poverty and by this father-to-be, in my case, threatened suicide. My family, you know, wouldn't help me. I was unemployed, but I was very willing to be a mother. It was an unplanned pregnancy. And I also wanted to ask about the equal rights issue. If it's a moral good for a woman to take the life of her unborn child, do you feel it should no longer be murder for a man to cause the death of his unborn child?
I'm having a little trouble featuring that situation.
Well, if you think it's a moral good for a woman to, you know, have an abortion, then do you think it shouldn't be murder for a man to cause the death of his unborn child?
I you know, there have been a lot of laws passed in recent years making, you know, so-called feticide laws, in which, yes, causing the death of a fetus by anyone but the woman in an illegal abortion is murder. And I think that those laws have had a very bad effect. What it's meant is women are now being put in prison for miscarriages that some district attorney decides is related to something that they did. And I think that's really, really bad. Now, about your situation, you know, I think that there is just no question that some women have abortions and they're sorry. They feel that, you know, their life took a terrible turn, that something good could have come out of that pregnancy. And I'm not going to say that they're wrong to feel that way. But what I will say is, in life, we make decisions, and sometimes we decide that that was the wrong decision. And that's just an inescapable part of being human. You know, some people get a divorce and they're sorry later, but we wouldn't say, oh, yeah, divorce should be illegal, because some people are sorry later. I would say that, you know, when studies have asked about coercion in abortion, because you mentioned that too, it's very, very few women tell the social scientists, yes, I had an abortion only because my parents wanted me to do it, or my husband wanted me to do it. There are usually a bunch of reasons. And yeah, some, I mean, I think it's probably a rare parent who doesn't want their 15-year-old daughter not to have a baby. So without taking away anything from the sorrow that you feel, and I understand that, I think your doctors were probably trying to do what they thought was medically best, and you disagree with them. But that's not the same as coercion.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Denise, and thanks for sharing your story. Let's go next to Susan in San Francisco. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Katha Pollitt, you are one of my heroes. I even wrote you a fan letter.
You did? Oh, thank you.
It was in the 90s about something you wrote about the change of life, about menopause. But the reason I'm calling is because I actually had 3 abortions, and I don't regret them. It was because I was in a relationship with someone who kept trying to be sober and wasn't. And I made decision after decision to not have a child who had an addict for a father. Later, I had a wonderful child. I didn't suffer from my abortions in terms of being able to conceive later. And I have a healthy and fabulous child who's now 23 years old. But I have never really talked about, I said I had an abortion, but to say I had 3 was somehow something I couldn't bring myself to say. So I want to thank you for reframing this discussion.
Oh, well, thank you for your call. You know, I know women who've had 5 abortions. So, you know, I think there is, nature wants us to be pregnant. And it's really hard to prevent that. When you think about it, okay, so from like when you get your period, you're what, 11 or 12, let's say, and then you have menopause, and that could be, you know, any time 45 on up. That's a lot of months to prevent the sperm and the egg from coming together. And you have to do it pretty much perfectly. There are so many. I had 2 friends in high school who got pregnant the first time they had sex. You know, it's like one time is enough. And so I think we need to forgive ourselves a little bit for our slip-ups and, you know, in the birth control thing. And birth control is not perfect. I look back at my life as I was writing this book, because I've never had an abortion. And I'm thinking, now, why is that? And I thought, oh, yeah, because you're so great. But no, I did all the things that other people do. I conducted my entire first affair when I was 22 years old without using birth control. By the time I got the pill, which was technically illegal for unmarried women in Massachusetts at the time, the relationship was over. I was prescribed a diaphragm by a mad scientist doctor that was the size of a dinner plate. You know, I could have... you know, I could hardly get that thing in there. And then when I went back to her, I'm sure it didn't work. And then I was just lucky. Then I went back to her and I said, you prescribed, you know, this is ridiculous. She says, oh, no. She says, most people prescribe diaphragms that are much too small. So I think every woman has had pregnancy scares. Every woman has taken chances. And, you know, some women are just luckier than others.
That's so true. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Susan, and sharing your story. Clearly, Katha, we've got full lines.
Oh, wow.
Tons of emails.
It's a great discussion.
People really want to talk about this. So, again, I'm speaking with Katha Pollitt about her new book, Pro Reclaiming Abortion Rights. And let's go next to Anne in San Francisco. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Hope that you can hear me okay.
Yeah, you're fine.
I'm a mother of 2 in San Francisco in my 30s, and I feel like the only part of this discussion that we're missing is the educating women about their bodies, which you never really hear about. And it's so shocking to me that so many women and girls, because you start, we should say girls at this point, because you start your period at, like you said, 11 years old. Why are women and girls not educated about how their bodies work? I am pro-abortion. I think that in very many circumstances, yes, it's fine and okay, but I wish that there was more education for women and girls, because it feels like that's missing, and without that, we will never move on out of the conversation we're having right now. In the future, we'll still be having the same conversation if we don't attack that aspect.
You're so right. You're just completely right. Sex education and more frank discussion of sex is so important. But look what we have instead. We have abstinence-only sex education in so many places, and where all they are taught about birth control by law, you can only discuss birth control with reference to its failure rates. And so you've got all these kids who think, oh, well, condoms don't work. Let's not bother. Yeah, the birth control pill, that's baby pesticide. So many methods of birth control now are being redefined as abortion. This is another thing, the birth control pill being an example, and emergency contraception being an example, that, you know, people believe that this is a way of, you know, having an abortion when it is not. But I completely agree with you. We need a much franker discussion that incorporates the idea that having sex is a normal part of being a human being. It's not some rare event that carries a contract to have a baby 9 months later.
We have a listener who emailed, how do you think we got to the point where even the right to contraceptives has been challenged in the national health coverage debate?
Well, I think that's political. I think the Republican Party has made an alliance with the anti-abortion movement that has given the anti-abortion movement incredible power. And when you add, it's not just Republicans. I mean, Bart Stupak, who was the person who, you know, made abortion totally banned under the Affordable Care Act. He was a Democrat. There are a lot of conservative Democrats. But I think that, you know, the way our politics is set up, conservatives have disproportionate power in every way. And now we're seeing with this whole disenfranchisement of people under these voter ID laws that will promote that.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Anne. Let's go next to Jim in San Francisco. Hi, Jim. Hi, Jim. Do you hear us? All right. Let's go to our next caller, Jefferson in San Francisco. Hi, Jefferson.
Hi. Let's see. Well, I greatly admire Ms. Paula's work. And first of all, I want to say I'm a member of the choir. I agree 100% on, you know, abortion rights and women's right to choose. That said, I would like to offer a quick, what may be seen as a criticism and a quick potential solution, because there's a lot of talk about the moral high ground here, but I really honestly believe this is not a moral battle. This is a political battle, and it's a power battle. It's a power struggle. And pro-choice was a great slogan when the female empowerment movement was gaining ground. But it's really easy from a politician's standpoint to stand up and be against abortion. And it's hard, I think, to stand up and say that you are for the government forcing women to have babies. And I think from a linguistic standpoint, the pro-choice movement would do well to consider putting politicians in that position and forcing them to talk about what they are in favor of and getting off this defensive standpoint of we're in favor of abortion. It's really difficult to have that discussion. But the minute you turn it around and say, are you in favor of the government forcing women to have babies, even people who are against abortion get really quiet.
Well, you know, this is where pro-choice, the term, came from. That was the framing. It was who decides. That was who decides was in, you know, that was back at the end of the 70s, I think, that where a libertarian framing was put forward in order to prevent Virginia and some other, you know, conservative states from passing anti-abortion legislation was the idea, who's going to decide? You, with your family and your doctor, of course, or the government. And that was a good framing, but it was limited because it meant you then couldn't ask for government help. You couldn't ask for funding. Mm-hmm. That promoted the Hyde Amendment because then it said, oh, she can have her own abortion, but I don't want to pay for it. Every framing carries this dark shadow. But thank you, Jefferson, and I'm really glad you're out there thinking about all these things.
Yes, thank you for calling, Jefferson. I think we have time for one more caller. Let's go to Tina in Bolinas. Hi, Tina.
Another big fan of Ms. Paulitz. Could you speak really specifically to the moral right aspect, please? Exactly what do you mean by that so that I can be talking about that out in the world, please? Thank you.
Well, you know, there's a lot in my book about this. It's a little hard to summarize, but so I hope you'll read the book and press it on your friends. But when I say moral right, I mean you have a moral right to decide what the shape of your own life is going to be. Of course, we all fall short, right? But in doing that, but what does society gain when we force people to have children that they can't take care of? This is not good for society to say to women, yeah, you have to have all these random babies with random people, and if you forget your birth control or even if you're raped, you have to have this baby. This is not a way to make a society that's healthy and strong. And I think that we all benefit when the people that are actually here get to develop as much of themselves as they can. We want women to be educated. We want them to go out and, you know, participate in the workforce and develop all their talents and gifts. And we want this for men, too. And, you know, having random babies isn't good for them either. And we want children to be wanted and to be born into a situation where they can be taken care of well. And that helps the whole society. So I see it that way.
Thank you, Tina. Thanks for calling in. And I think we're going to have time for one more caller. You're our last caller, Shirley in Mountain View. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm glad you got me on. I'm very much pro-choice, always have been. But I had a kind of epiphany a while ago, a couple of years ago, when I realized why the Catholics and the evangelicals don't want abortion. And that is that they think the soul comes in at the second of conception. And they think if you have abortion, that's preventing a soul from coming in, one. And that's also why they're against birth control, because that prevents a soul that's waiting up there in heaven from coming down and being put in a human body. So I think it would be useful for people who are pro-choice to understand that. This is not an intellectual argument at all. It's an argument based on religion/mythology. And I think we might get further along if we acknowledge that.
Thank you. 30 seconds.
Well, I just want you to be aware that in the 1960s, the Southern Baptists were in favor of liberalizing abortion laws. So you can read religion, you know, you can read the Bible a lot of different ways. And I think that you're right. It is a religious belief, but that can change. Religion changes.
Thank you for calling in. Katha Pollitt is author of Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. She's a longtime Nation columnist. She'll be speaking tomorrow at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 1 o'clock, and then tomorrow night in Berkeley at the Hillside Club at 7. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Katha, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me, Rose.
Thank
fun.
You. Thank you. And thank you so much for your calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Questions do you have about Proposition 47? On the next Your Call, we'll have a debate about Prop 47, which would reduce the classification of non-serious and non-violent property and drug crimes from a felony to a misdemeanor. Proponents say money spent on incarceration should be spent on social programs. Opponents say Prop 47 fails to punish potentially dangerous felons and burdens the system. So where do you stand on Prop 47? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.